You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome to the Big Sui, presented by DraftKings.
Why are you listening to this show?
The podcast that seems very similar to the other Dan Le Batard podcast.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that.
In fact, the only difference seems to be this imaging.
I have been tempted in restaurants just walking past tables to grab somebody's fries that if they're just there. That hasn't happened to you guys?
I've done it.
And now, here's the marching man to nowhere, Fat Face, and the habitual liar.
Welcome to Meadowlarkers 64, and we actually have a quorum today. We got a full squad after a couple of weeks of a few of us not being there. I mean, I think we all missed 3 weeks in a row, right? Yeah, I wasn't there last week, and then Kate was doing Kate Fagan things, and Amin was Amining, and here we are now. First things first, before we get started with this episode, which is about a new Netflix series called Breakpoint, all about the ins and outs of the tennis tour, the WTA and the ATP and the Grand Slams in between. New Netflix series directed by Martin Webb. We're going to get to that in a second. But we have two things to go first on our honorary captains. I only have one today for the number 64, and it is going to be a Kate Fagan favorite and a not very big favorite of mine because it's a horrible memory if you were a San Francisco 49er fan. That would be Jim Burt, New York Giants nose tackle who crushed Joe Montana, which led to a 49-3 rout in the NFC Championship game in 1986.
Howard, I did some research. This is a bit of a departure.
Yes.
But in honor of our topic this week, I looked up the number 64 players on the WTA and the men's tour.
Oh, so, that's a nice little,
you know, because twist.
Who
I figured,
is ranked 64 right now?
Well, on the women's side, you're gonna have to help me here. It's Donna Vekic.
Donna Vekic, who lost last night to Aryna Sabalenka. Donna Vekic, who was also suffered a horrible knee injury, and it's so good to see her back. She's a top 20 player. So her being number 64, she's on the way back. She's now going to be in the 30s, I believe, after making a quarterfinal run last night.
And then on the men's side, it's Wami. Is it Wami Munar?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Munar's a good player.
Okay.
He's up there because that's pretty much where his level is. Maybe he can get a little further down. But Vekic is a 64 simply because she got hurt. She's a really good player.
I figured since, you know, I think it was probably a year ago, we were talking about tennis and how they're struggling to introduce storylines, that it's appropriate we are now talking about Breakpoint. And I figured I'd also introduce some storylines at the level 64 ranked players. Even though I didn't know the storyline, I just knew the names. But then I figured you would know the storylines, and here we are.
I love that. The second thing, order of business that we've got before we get going into a break point is today in my inbox, I was offered a media copy of Kate Fagan's new book that serves as an adventure through basketball history and an insider's guide to pop culture and the women's game, Hoop Muses, available to the sports media. Tell us about your new book, Kate Fagan. It appears that it is coming out March 7th, 2023.
Yes. Howard, you're the best. Hold on. Let me get a copy of it. Hold on.
Oh, there it is.
Look at that.
Hard copies just came in.
Nice.
So here we are.
Look at that. Put it up there. Why is it not already in your background? We got
that is great. I gotta put it up.
You gotta put it back there right next to the mixing shelf. Bowl. Next to the exactly where you do your mashed potatoes. There it is.
I'll have to lean this way.
That's right. We'll work on
That's
the placement
enough.
As we go.
That's good enough.
Yes, congratulations to Kate Fagan. Book coming out in a couple of months. Not even.
That's right.
Five and a half weeks. And yes. Of course, I'm going to do...
Did you say yes to that email? I mean, this is a cliffhanger for me.
I did not respond.
Good. Perfect. All right.
I did not respond for two reasons. Reason number one is that I figured I could go directly to the source.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And two, you got to support your people, man. So if your friends have books coming out, buy a copy. You know,
don't get that freebie stuff. Don't, right?
Exactly.
I mean?
If you're not going to review the book... Don't ask for a free book. I mean, seriously, if you're not,
thanks,
you know, it's just not the way to go. So I always say, you know, we're all in the media here. If we support, we do better. So support and do better. Meanwhile,
just intensely a bunch of money.
Right. Meanwhile, we are here at Breakpoint. Breakpoint is the new Netflix series directed by Martin Webb. Martin Webb, if that name sounds familiar, he was the one who had done... The Drive to Survive, the NASCAR, wasn't it?
No.
F1.
Formula 1. No, I'm sorry, Formula 1. I'm sorry. I always mess up my auto racing that I don't watch.
A lot of angry tweets coming your way.
And they're
Is
coming
that
my-
like messing up DC and Marvel? Is that what that's like?
Oh, yeah. Like probably but a bigger, even bigger gap. The Formula 1 people are very snooty. Even Chris Whittingham is sitting across from me right now, and he's got a very snooty look on his face.
Well, tell Chris Whittingham to take that snooty look off of his face because I watch neither of them. I simply made a mistake. I know the difference by looking at the cars. You can tell which one is which. I just made a mistake.
It's obvious F1 is way more sophisticated than... I'm assuming that's what F1 people think.
Yes.
Sport is more nuanced with better storylines and in exotic locations. And it's about all of those global sophisticated traveling greatness, something, right? I mean...
Yes, and the performance vehicles that they drive that aren't stock cars like NASCAR.
They're not stock cars, right?
The tracks that are all winding and are
actual
better
roads.
Test. Yeah, a better test of your driving ability rather than, you know, just doing laps like they do in NASCAR.
And also you get to go hang out with all the super rich people in Monte Carlo. Yep.
Yes.
You know, and so after you get...
Diverse international kind of flair as opposed to... The southern.
Zipping around the track. Exactly. And one is very European and one is very American. You know, we just zap around and do laps and circles and look out for crashes. And also, Chris Whittingham, I know the difference between NASCAR and Formula One because I saw Iron Man 2.
Oh, that's right.
So where are we, folks? I am, of course, the tennis guy of the trio here. So, of course, I devoured all five episodes really, really quickly. Amin, I believe you are on episode 2. Kate, you are through episode 4. And neither one of you being really, really hardcore tennis people, I believe this series is actually for you, trying to introduce a new generation of tennis players away from the era of Serena and Djokovic and Nadal and Federer, trying to bring in usher in a new generation of watchers and of players. And I guess that the really one of the conceits of this doc series has been to discuss how difficult or to reveal how difficult it is to show you what it's like, what life on tour is like, and the pressures of trying to step into this void left by not just really, really good players of the previous generation, but legends. I mean, this new generation is the equivalent of taking over for Bill Russell and Jordan and Joma and all of that. It's like the biggest of the big. And now you've got these young players now trying to make their way in a very, very different time. Amin, start with you. What were your thoughts on the first two episodes?
Well, first of all, I thought it was very refreshing to see another sport that clings to its past and doesn't want to move into the future. It's not just basketball, where there's this idea that, like, it's Jordan, and don't tell me anything about what's happening now. Tennis is kind of fighting the same thing, is that people are so attached to a generation that was legendary, as you said. When you talk about Nadal, Djokovic, and Federer on the men's side, when you talk about the Williams sisters on the women's side, even Maria Sharapova, who made several appearances in the series.
Dark-haired Sharapova.
Yeah. That means she's entering into her Sith phase. But it's funny to watch a sport try to fight its own ghosts. Because on the one hand, obviously, you want to cherish and celebrate history, but you don't want to drown in it. You want people to know that it lives on, everything marches on, and there will be new names and new faces, and eventually new legends that happen. So that was one. The other was, I don't consider myself obviously a diehard tennis fan. I'm also not an idiot. Like, I know many of the players. This is my first time ever really contemplating the idea of, wow, man, we're watching these people melt down real time and they're narrating it for you. And it got me thinking about what is it about tennis and, I guess, golf that makes their concentration so, I don't know what other word to use, fragile. It seems so fragile to me compared to, you know, players in basketball and football or soccer, where it's like, yeah, people are screaming and they want you to lose the whole time.
Are you talking, Amin, about the time that Jamel and I were having lunch and we were watching a tennis match and she was asking me, why do they have to be so quiet?
Mm-hmm.
She's like, when someone's shooting a free throw, there are people yelling right. And screaming and waving their arms. And how come in tennis you've got to be church quiet? And it was like, well, because that's the nature of the sport, part of it. And the reason is also because you have to hear the calls from the chair ump. But it's actually more than that, isn't it? It's the nature of the game in that the sport hasn't quite decided if it's a sport where the people come in and make all kinds of noise and do what sports fans do, or if it's some sort of a quiet little country club pastime where you have to show decor and you have to have, you know, a certain etiquette that is similar to golf.
I guess my question goes beyond that. It's almost like it feels like a market inefficiency. A player that would be raised in a different kind of environment when it comes to adversity, when it comes to hostile environments, that would play in this sport. I mean, obviously, beyond, you have to be talented, you have to be physically gifted, all those things, but it would seem to me like if you had brought that mentality from team sports over, the idea that, yeah, they all hate you. Yes, yes, they're not. Oh, and then I felt the crowd turning on his side. Yes! Why do you care? Why is that something so top of mind? It blew my mind to hear them admit to it. You know, you always hear about, oh, and the crowd's turning. I'm like, these guys don't care. They're focused on the game. And
oh,
now
they care.
They care incredibly.
Don't you think it's almost though, even though it's easy to act like it's apples to apples, it's like, okay, here's a dynamic sport where, you know, speed, strength, et cetera, is key. And so is it in basketball. The more I've been, and Howard, you'd be proud of me, I've been immersed in tennis lately. The more I'm like, wow, I think tennis might be the biggest mind I've ever thought about when it comes to a sport. So I'm like, I don't even know that you can even say, like, I'm not saying you're saying this, Amin, but like, let's say the mental resilience of somebody like Steph Curry, who is willing to step out into an imposing court and continue to play the way he plays. I don't even think that is applicable to how he might do if he had been a tennis player, because it is not even being alone somewhere inside your own mind and not even being able to like throw a great bounce pass to a teammate for a layup to like get some small level of confidence back in yourself. There is no small play you can make. Well, Howard, you would know this better. Maybe I'm not exactly right here, but like, I feel like on the basketball court, you can you're not shooting well and you can just do some other things and build yourself up. In tennis, it is just like a vortex downward if things aren't going well. Break Point, as well as a novel I just read, Kerry Soto Is Back, which we may or may not get to, I have really decided that tennis is a terrifying sport.
Yeah, well, let's throw some ground rules here first. Number one, absolutely individual sport. That's the first thing. All the individual sports are that, right? How different is that than, you know, boxing? You're across the ring from somebody and there's no way out. Like, what do I do, you know, when this person is better than me? How do I get back into this? Individual sports, ditto with golf, whereas but the difference between golf and tennis is that in golf, you're competing against the course and as much as you're competing against the players. It's really you against the course and the elements. But the other thing about tennis as well is no teammates. Mm-hmm. And some of the team competition, a lot of players really prefer that. That's why they like to play doubles during the same tournament. They're playing with and against their opponents in the same tournament during the same week. You may face your doubles partner in the same tournament that week in singles. The other thing that you have in tennis that is very different as well is they're changing the rules now because they want to go live in the now, but no coaching. Your coach is historically in tennis. Your job is to solve your own problems. Mm. You're not supposed to talk to anybody. You're not supposed to look up at your box and say, what am I doing? This guy's killing me, or she's, you know, beating me down the line. And why is this happening? This was not part of the game plan. The job is to solve your own problems. Serena Williams was legendary at this, and that, you know, which is why she was so upset in 2018 in the Osaka final when she was criticized for coaching. You know, for taking coaching. She's like, I don't cheat, you know, because I solve my own problems. Right. Roger Federer, same thing. Did not like the rule changes where now when you're on the same side as your coach, you can talk to them. A lot of the old timers don't like that. They're like, no. The history of this sport is you're out there on your own, figure it out. And so there's that piece of it as well. The other piece of it in terms of the, you know, absolutely the mind, the messing around with your mind in playing the game is that the nature of the score constantly shifts because you're resetting all the mm-hmm. time. You can win a first set 6-love, but that doesn't mean you've got an X point lead. Yeah. It means it goes back to zero. So a lot of these players have, you know, you're dealing with it in a way very differently than with other sports. Most sports are cumulative. This sport is not.
Howard, how does high IQ manifests itself in tennis? What is a high IQ player in tennis?
It's almost like this thing where I'm like, high IQ, that could be the worst thing that ever happened to you in tennis.
Well, in baseball, that's what Billy Beane used to say all the time. He's like, I was too smart to play baseball. He's like, I was too busy thinking. I was thinking all the time. And sometimes you can't think. You have to go play. And one of the things that this series does that I found very interesting, and then we can talk about the actual construction of the series, but the downtime and the way that you're preparing for each of these matches and the way that you're supposed to, you know, you're getting out there and in the heat of the competition, you know. The one thing I was also going to bring up earlier, I forgot, was also because there are no home and away games in tennis except for the team Davis Cup competitions where you know, you may be playing in front of your home crowd, is that the etiquette of the sport suggests that the fans are supposed to be polite to both sides, to Amin's point before about, oh, the crowd is turning against me. The nature of tennis fandom has been you only cheer for winners. So when Roger Federer comes in, the argument had always been that every game is a home game for Roger Federer because he's so beloved. And everyone is like, I got no shot with this crowd. Every environment against Roger is a hostile environment. And I think it was in the first episode, it's all about Nick Kyrgios, the Australian, you know, head case that he is. They also showed the final of last year's Australian Open between Rafa Nadal and Daniil Medvedev, where the crowd clearly was on Nadal's side, and you could just see what it did. And you can make an argument that after Medvedev lost that, he was up 2-0. He had already won the U.S. Open against Djokovic a few months earlier. He was the number one player in the world. He was up 2-0 and with a love 40. He's about to kill Nadal. It's over. Nadal makes this incredible comeback. Nadal wins the tournament. Medvedev hasn't been the same player since. He's been ruined. He got knocked out in the fourth round this year by Seb Korda, the United States. And all of that stems from the Australian Open crowd turned on him for the final 3.5 hours of that match.
Let's pull back a little bit, because I feel like one thing we always try to do if we're doing like a review of a doc is like give our kind of our takes on the way it's made and the hurdles to it. And I think that for this one, it's made by the same folks that made Drive to Survive, but they face a whole different challenge than when they're making the F1 doc, because as they tell you in the first episode, at a Grand Slam, there's 128 players in the men's draw, 128 players in the women's draw. It's like you can't have that many cameras. You've kind of really got to pick who you're following and like cross your fingers and hope for the best, right, as Netflix opposed to thinks. Right. And I feel like every time I've Googled it in the last 48 hours, everyone's like, and this person now, you know, crashed out of Australia 2023. Like what is it? The SI cover jinx. No, the Madden cover jinx that everyone jinx always talks about.
And the SI jinx as well.
And so I think, well, one, I think that this doc is incredibly well made. Like, it's very stylish. The access is incredible. Mm-hmm. And the people they have access to, I don't know if it's that they're truly focused on introducing you to the stars of the next generation, or that they knew trying to get access to the Nadals and the Djokovic's was like a non-starter, either financially or the way that access would play out. But they're focused on basically all of the players other than that. And the access is phenomenal. I think the biggest thing I have now, and I'm like almost done with the fourth episode, is strangely, I feel like I now have storylines. So I will kind of check in on the Australian, probably not the Australian Open, because everybody I've been introduced to is apparently out of it. But I will check in on the next tournament to see how they're doing, but I don't find the doc itself compelling. If that makes, like, I am not motivated, like, when one ends, if we weren't having this discussion, I probably wouldn't have watched the next one, and yet I now have a few players that I'm interested in following. I don't know, Amin, how you felt.
Yeah, I thought, through two episodes, I thought if you narrowed it down to 30 minutes, it would have been a lot more compelling. They show a lot of tennis. It's almost like a digest of the match. And if the goal is, while I was watching, I was thinking, if I were a tennis fan, I've already watched these matches. I already remember what happened. I really don't need this recap. If I'm not a tennis fan, it gets a little boring after a while. Just too much. I don't need that. Unless it's stuff that's where, what's the young lady's name? Isla.
No, Aya Tomljanovic?
Yes, Tomljanovic.
Who, by the way, is the woman who ended Serena Williams' career at the U.S. Open just a few months later.
Yeah. Mm. So she says at one point, she's talking about that era right there. That's where it all changed for me. And how it spiraled, or the spiraling that we talked about. And then afterwards, she's in the tunnel with her coach and she's in tears and said, maybe I'm not good enough. Which, again, kudos to the access and the openness that these athletes would be this vulnerable to question and doubt. Am I good enough to even do this? And this woman is number 40 some odd in the world. So, I mean, that's really, really, really good. There's 10,000 women playing pro tennis. She's 40th. That's insane that she's sitting there after this match saying that was the point where everything went bad and am I even good enough to do this? That, to me, that's compelling. That grips me. That, even if I don't care for the sport, that's a meaningful moment. But like, and then I was down in the first set, but then I came back in the second set, and then like, this is like an extended highlight that I didn't need.
Right, because it kind of reads like an old school gamer. Like it watches like an old school gamer at times. But to your point, Amin, and Howard, you may not need this because you might just intrinsically understand what happened in that point that broke her. But I feel like a missed opportunity, at least through where I am, is to get into the psychology more than just saying it's a psychological sport or that point broke me. I don't know why, and it broke her. Right. Like, I don't know. I know a little bit more about tennis maybe than the average person. So I'd be like, OK, I know what break point means, but I can't necessarily say that everybody who's turning on this doc would know what a break point is. And I feel like there are moments where it's like in these matches, I feel like I would learn more if they were like the match Amin's talking about.
Yeah.
If they would have stopped there and said,
and
like,
some science. Yeah.
And like, yeah, here is because, as I mentioned, this novel that I recently read about this fictional female tennis player, it is so much about the psychology of tennis and why she's playing every point. And I felt like the book was helpful, because it really got into how you can be broken mentally or how you can break somebody else. And I want the doc to do more of that.
Yeah. Well, and what the doc does, and once again, it's a great question, because as you move on, both of you, when you get to episode five, if you get to episode five, you know, Kate, your question, or actually, Amin, your question is raised and never answered, which is, okay, who got access? How did you choose who this series was going to be about? So essentially what the documentary does, if it's a documentary, what it does is it is focusing on essentially a different player each episode as the season moves on. It starts out with the Grand Slams. It starts out with Nick Kyrgios, who is sort of the bad boy of tennis right now.
The bad boy of tennis.
And his travails at the Australian Open, because he's supposed to be the next big thing. He has never yet been the next big thing, even though it's very clear he may be the most talented tennis player in the history of tennis. It may very well be that he's got that much ability.
That was the other thing that I was kind of really, you know, impressed by, was Andy Roddick being very blunt in his criticism about Kyrgios. I was like, oh wow, he's not pulling punches here.
Speaking of Roddick, because this was one moment that I kind of like paused, was, you know, as you mentioned, they had like Sharapova, they have Chris Evert, they have like, you know, legends of the past now commenting on the current generation. And Andy Roddick has that thing where he's like, if I had his talent, talking about Nick Kyrgios, which is like kind of this thing that people like Roddick, I don't think it's a good look for Roddick, if I'm honest, because I feel like it's basically saying, I worked harder than him. I'm one of those salt of the earth guys who pulled himself up by his bootstraps. And it's just like,
and in that sport, because the racial overtones are so clear, the tropes get in there immediately that he's a head case. Exactly. He's wasting his talent. We've heard the same thing with Gael Monfils. Mm-hmm. You know, if he were less of a showman and more of a serious player, then he'd be a much better player. Well, you could say the same thing about damn near every player. And if Roddick had a better backhand, he would have won more majors instead of the one that he had. So there is that. The second episode focuses on Matteo Berrettini, who's the Italian number one, and his battles to try and get to the top of the sport. It just so turns out that he is dating Ila Tomljanovic on the WTA side. And of course, they broke up. And after that, after the documentary aired, Ila Tomljanovic, which they don't mention, was also dating Nick Kyrgios before Berrettini.
Is that common?
Yes, it's such an insular sport. They're all dating each other. It's constant. Let's face it. One of the biggest reasons that Sharapova and Serena had the big beef that they had was because at one point they both dated Gregor Dimitrov. So there's all that sort of intrigue that goes into it. And so you have these players, and spoiler alert in that, to your point earlier, in episode five, the epic battle is Nadal Djokovic. That's the entire story of that tournament. They do not show a single second of that semifinal match, which made me think. And then Djokovic the other day gave an interview about, you know, whether or not, because he's got a hamstring injury, and whether or not he was faking injury or not. And he was upset about this. And he made a comment that said, I don't know, maybe I'll use this for my documentary, or maybe I won't. I'm like, they control their own footage.
Do they?
It's what it sounds like. I'm like, wait a minute. So maybe this is some Last Dance stuff where the individual is controlling the footage, which is why we don't see anybody else. I'm like, how could you not have a single second of Nadal Djokovic? That was the match of the year.
Who's their union chief? How'd they strike that deal?
I mean, so along the line, that has to be addressed.
So the show is co-produced, right? It's Netflix, ATP, and the WTA, right?
But the Grand Slams are separate from the ATP and WTA tours. So maybe what it sounds like, and I'm going to go make a few phone calls and find this out. It sounds like that the star players, whether it's Nadal and Djokovic, made a deal with the Grand Slams. You're not using my footage for anything. That footage may belong to me, or unless Wimbledon wants to make a documentary, you can use my footage, but they can't on Netflix because that's not, so they're focusing on other players, players that may have less leverage. From a how it's made standpoint, Kate, very disturbing to me that the Australian Open, the number one story of the Australian Open, is the 9-time champion Novak Djokovic was deported.
Yeah, they mentioned
he was deported.
Yeah. Like,
and
he's not
in
here.
The documentary, they say, "Oh, because his visa wasn't renewed." What are you talking about? He got deported. That was the story of the entire tournament, that a professional athlete was kicked out of the country.
They put him in that hotel, right?
They put him in the hotel, exactly. And just raced right by that.
They gloss over that.
Interesting editorial choice there, especially because he wins the tournament.
Right? It just feels like it's, from a documentary maker point of view, just chaos.
Yeah.
Like, there is just so much unpredictability. You don't agree? I mean,
can we say something? This is not a documentary. This is reality TV. This isn't a documentary. This is reality.
It's not
TV.
A docuseries.
It's
reality
not a docuseries.
TV.
It's reality TV. That's what it is. We are made to care about these characters and their love lives and their personal lives and all this stuff. It's not that doesn't mean it's not interesting. That doesn't mean it's not expository at times, but it does mean that it's not a this isn't Ken Burns who's doing this, right? This is closer to Real Housewives than it is, you know.
Yeah, and I think that we're in a point right now, which is very much worth talking about. Interesting in your thoughts on this, Kate, is that none of them are documentaries. I've been calling them showcases because what they do is they showcase the star. I was watching the Shaq doc on HBO. And same thing, it's just Shaquille O'Neal in a chair talking about himself and talking about how great he is and finding other people to talk about how great he is without an opposing view. It's him talking about his narrative and how he views his life. That is not documentary.
Executive produced by?
Executive produced by LeBron James, Maverick Carter. So here we go.
Shaquille O'Neal.
The same group. And Shaquille O'Neal.
That's the most important part.
So you're right. Showcase is a good term for it. But regardless of whether you think this is a gritty Ken Burns documentary, docuseries / showcase for tennis, the point remains that I feel like they're in a tricky position, that their cameras can almost never be where they are supposed to be. And then at times it feels like we are left to like retroactively build a story out of what has happened. And that I think that that at times comes through in the series. I don't know if it changes Howard at the end, if they end up, you know, having some moment.
Kagan.
Yeah.
We don't know because it's actually not 5 episodes. It's 10, and the 6th episode begins in June. We don't know. It's not over yet. And so, which is kind of a strange choice as well. But 100%. And I think that when you're watching this, they made a decision because of that trickiness. And it appeared that the decision that they made was, all right, we're going to focus on these 6 characters.
Yeah.
And wherever they go is how far we go, even if the storyline of that actual tournament changes, because we don't have any control over that. We're just going to follow these players. And if they crash out in the first round, they crash out in the first round. And as we're watching, you know, this documentary drops, every one of them none of them made the second week. Right. So Nick Kyrgios has a knee injury. He's not even in the Australian Open this year. And Tomljanovic, same thing. She's hurt. She's not in the tournament. Berrettini got knocked out in the first round by Andy Murray. Nadal got knocked out in the second round, injured. Mackie McDonald took him out. But Doze is out. They're all out. And so people are talking about this as the Netflix jinx. But I think that you're right, Kate, that they didn't really have much of a choice. It was, okay, we can't have cameras in every single place. We probably have all these different restrictions in terms of who we can follow and who we can't. So to Amin's point, let's make it a Real Housewives type of thing. And we're going to say, here are the 6 storylines we're following and let's see where we go with it.
I have not watched the F1 series. Is that similar, Kate? Are they following a handful of drivers that they just hope would be the good ones?
Well, there's fewer, what are there, 20 drivers, you know, so you just have much more of a hit rate if you're following 6 people and you know already know who the top ranked guys are, like you're probably going to catch, you know, who's in one or two of the cars that are in the, you know, in the top five. So it's just an easier, yeah, just an easier hit rate. Gotcha. On that.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Can we also talk for a second about young people? Because I'm old, so it all, so watching young people always makes me laugh. And one of the things about watching, you know, youth being wasted on the young or whatever is how these tennis players move. And we watch the way they move, the way they interact. And, you know, tennis is a sport where, generally speaking, even though I know the prize money has gone up and everything else, you are paying for everything out of pocket. And the only money that you make is if you win or is if you get big shoe deals or if you get endorsements. And so most the rule of thumb had been previously that, you know, if you're not in the top 50, you're not breaking even. That maybe has been pushed out to the top 75, top 100. But generally speaking, if you're not one of the top 30, 40 players in the world, you're struggling financially. And when you look at how insular the game is, like, you know, because the ATP and the WTA, they play joint tournaments. There's a, you know, a dozen joint tournaments across the year, you know, the Grand Slams and then some of the Masters 1000s. But generally speaking, they're in two different parts of the world. Or two different, you know, they're not playing in the same venues every single week. So having relationships has been very interesting and very difficult. It made me laugh that virtually all of these people in this documentary, they all sort of met their significant others over Instagram or they're dating other tennis players.
Yeah.
And I was like, who knew that IG was a dating service? And I just thought that the way that they're talking about their lives, to your point, Amin, about whether or not this was a compelling doc, I was like, okay, you know, how compelling is it to see these really, really young, rich people with their messy rooms full of swag or full of
sponsored product,
sponsored products full of gear, you know, on their phones, meeting people online. I'm like, it's just sort of it was a weird sort of world that they're in. But it was very funny that the one thing throughout the five episodes is we met on Instagram.
Yeah.
Yes, that was a common theme. Yeah, I think, you know, we've talked enough on this show too about what you were talking about, Howard, of the actual life of tennis players that is unlike, at least, you know, unlike most of the sports we talk about here. But watching this doc, maybe you know this because you're so involved in tennis, but like there's something so like dangerously insular about tennis is kind of how it kind of feels at times, where you're like, these are the two people that I travel everywhere with and spend every minute with while I'm traveling. And one of them's my coach, which is already a complicated one-on-one relationship. Not to mention that then you go get dinner with your coach. Then you get them coffee in the morning. It just feels like, unlike any other sport we talk about, like just dangerously insular.
Not only dangerously insular, but on top of that, you've got this incredibly difficult imbalance, which is all of us work for you, player. And so player X, we're all in your employ. So we are also at the risk, at the mercy of your moods and the whole thing, which is why they keep changing coaches all the time. And it is incredibly emotionally volatile. And then there's another thing about it that the documentary does not go into, which you knew they weren't going to go into because it's a showcase and not a documentary, is on the WTA side, the fact that they're all dating their coaches.
They're dating their coaches. Yeah. I was surprised we didn't get
coaches,
any of that.
They're sleeping with their coaches. They have and
they once only mention the ones that are married, right? There's like the, who's the Tunisian player?
Yes. Anne Jabeur is married and her coach is her husband.
Well, he's the fitness guy.
No, it's her husband.
So he's, right. I thought she had a coach and fitness and it doesn't matter.
Yes.
He's part of the insular trio that goes everywhere. I am curious in the next chunk of five, because I don't know how you do a 10-part series, about half of it on women's tennis players, and none of them are going to be gay. Like, they're all just going to be straight.
Well, they do talk about Maria Sakkari, but Maria Sakkari, like, there's always been this question, you know, she doesn't talk about her relationship, so nobody knows if she's gay or not.
But she's with the son of the prime minister of Greece. I'm sorry, I don't want to, like, gossip about...
Yes, that's right. That's right. And so it's funny because there are, it's a weird... Tennis is a very weird sport in that regard because... On the one hand, it's not that different from the old days of Jan Stevenson in golf, where they put her in the bathtub with all the golf balls. It's like, okay, we still need you to sell. We need you to sell sex. We need you to sell sex appeal because we're trying to build the sport. And so tennis, you have this really weird thing where you've got this sort of, you know, it's a sport. You're out there sweating, you're playing, but you also, you know, are, you know, you've got, you know, the glammed up manicure while you're supposed to hit a tennis ball. And so you're like, it's a very strange sort of dynamic there. Not the same exactly sort of homophobia as you saw with like Kim Mulkey and some of the women's basketball stuff. But there is sort of this expectation in some ways where, you know, where they're expecting you, like when you look at the WTA finals, they have them all out there in their, you know, $10,000 evening gowns for the cover of the media guide, et cetera. So there's still, you know, there is still that, and they're all wearing 4-inch heels, even though their feet have been put through the ringer throughout the entire, you know, tennis, the tennis calendar. So there's absolutely that. I'm interested too in what they do with the next few episodes. But yeah, I mean, the underbelly of those relationships, it is so insular. It's so intense. These are the only people you spend time with. And I agree with Federer's argument about how, you know, the coaching has gone a bit overboard because it's almost like the coaches are now helicopter parents. It's like when you know, the minute you hit a ball, and you miss or whatever, the player immediately turns around and looks at their box like for approval. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, are you well-developed people or not? And it's in, you know, you look at another person who's not in the documentary, Naomi Osaka, who just took the entire year off, pregnant, having a baby, but also you can tell is really struggling with being a tennis professional. And, you know, you kind of, you know, I mean, I meant to bring this up earlier when you were talking about Tomljanović, talking about whether she was good or not. I don't think it's true in the other sports. But generally in tennis, you're playing in thirds, right? In tennis, you're playing a third of the players you're way better than, depending on your draw, if you're a top player.
Yeah.
A third of the players you're even with, if you're in the middle of the pack, if you're in the top 20, 25, somewhere in there. And then there's a third of the players that are demonstrably better than you to make you sit there in the tunnel after you lose going, I'm not good enough to play this game. So the difference between, you know, somebody who's in the top 30 and Rafa Nadal or Serena Williams.
Right.
You know,
it's massive. It's
massive.
Exponential.
Serena, you know, where Roger Federer has got 103 titles.
Right.
And some of these players have been on tour for 15 years and don't have one at any level, not a 250, not a 500, not a 1,000, and certainly not a Grand Slam.
Let me ask you something else, Howard, as we're talking about coaches, the impact of coaches. Kyrgios does not have a coach.
He does not.
How unusual is that? And do you feel like that contributes to why he's, you know, ranked in the hundreds despite being this all-world talent?
Well, Kyrgios is ranked that high because he's constantly injured. But when he's actually playing, he's a top 15 player and he should be a top 10 player. But not having a coach absolutely sort of, well, I mean, because you need, you know, information. And, you know, I think we all need some level of coaching. Medvedev doesn't have a coach. Tsonga didn't have a coach. Monfils didn't have a coach for a while. Sometimes they go in and out. But most players have a coach. And most players have, you know, some of them switch coaches all the time. It happens way more often on the women's tour. And part of the reason is because of the stuff we're not talking about. It's like, boy, how come this one's had four coaches in 3 years? How come you win a Grand Slam and then you immediately fire your coach, right? I mean, so there's all kinds of stuff happening that they're not talking about that people know is happening behind the scenes. So, I mean, I think as a documentary, it's been... it was interesting to watch the players come off the court, and it wasn't too much tennis for me. It was a little, you know, it was a little jump cutty because they start using the jump cut. So you're not getting a feel for the match, but I do think that, you know, you're right. When you're watching, you want to know what is it about this sport that makes it so different. And part of the reason is all the stuff we're talking about here, about all the things that are absolutely in your head. And one of the biggest things that's in your head as a tennis player that I don't think exists in other sports is the gap between the very, very top players and everybody else. On the women's side, it's much less. On the women's side, like right now, you've got the 20, you know, Azarenka is playing Sabalenka. One's a 22, one's a 24, and they're in the semifinals. But on the men's side, for the past 20 years, it's these top three guys and everybody else, and nobody else can come close to them. And you see on the women's side, you see, which is why this documentary is really sort of interesting, who's going to, the subtext of all this should be like sort of called the Serena void, because now that she's not in the picture anymore, there is this scramble. And so for Tomljanovic to wonder if she's good enough, everybody can win on the women's side now. It's a matter of being able to handle the emotional pressure of being able to play. And what Tomljanovic was really talking about is, I'm having trouble handling this emotionally. The moments are too big for me. Why is it they call it concrete elbow when you're out there playing and you're supposed to be nice and fluid and you're just, and the nerves are eating you alive. And that's what that was the Sakkari episode. I think it was episode 3, where essentially she's a choker and she's trying to deal with the fact and that she's choking and she knows it. I'm a better player. I mean, you go back to 2020. How did you have two teenagers playing in the US Open final? The kids were the ones who held their nerve better than everybody else. And Sakkari actually came out and said it, where she said, I want to win so badly. And that vulnerability I thought was really interesting, because they're admitting stuff that the rest of us will never admit. But having your nerves just out there on display and not really being able to talk to anybody else is a big deal.
Yeah, I spent a good amount of the time while watching trying to get at like what translates from the sport I know best, basketball, to tennis in terms of what makes a great player. Because as you just said with Sakkari, it's not the will to win, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Like, she clearly is training. Unlike Kyrgios, who they're trying to make it clear he's kind of parachuting in and out of tennis, like, she's putting in the effort, she has the desire to win, and yet maybe it's some sort of like, just she wants it too much. So you also have to want it so much, but like not so much that it defines you. So there's like this weird collection of traits that you need as a tennis player. And I'm also thinking, like, wouldn't it be so interesting if we could like expose every basketball player that we think is amazing? Like, would LeBron, if he'd played tennis, be a great tennis player? Or would he have like, you know, only kid syndrome, where he wouldn't be able to like handle the moments of failure where you're purely exposed? Like, tennis is very interesting to me in that way.
Howard, like, months ago on Metal Arkers, you said, you described tennis as a sport about managing like your ability to manage failure, basically, or something around those. I wish I had the exact term. It just popped in my mind as Kate was describing this feeling, which is, you know, basically to be a great tennis player, it seems like you got to be able to like deal with not being good sometimes. And, you know, I thought about, we had a conversation with DeMarcus Ware the other day, and I asked him, because, you know, he told a very personal story about being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that was the moment where he realized, look, if I want to do this football thing, I can't come back home, basically, because it's a lot of bad negative influences back there. And because I asked him, when was the furthest you felt from achieving this dream? And it was that moment. And I said, the opposite. When was the moment when you thought, man, I'm not only am I awesome, I'm one of the greatest to ever do this? And he said, never. And he said, this week or whatever, when they announced the nominees for the Hall of Fame. And I said, how's that possible? He said, because I played every single down terrified. Terrified that I was going to lose my job. Terrified that the guy, like, there's someone coming for my job. Terrified that I was going to, you know, this is going to be the last game I played. And it was such a you know, very kind of vulnerable, but also it explains a whole hell of a lot, right? The idea that the fear is what's driving this greatness. And I think it was it the Italian player?
Berrettini.
Berrettini, who talked about that when he got hurt in his match. You know, he rolled his ankle, I think, and then he dropped two sets to the kid, the Spanish kid who's 17 or
Carlos
whatever.
Carlos Alvarez.
Yeah, Alcaraz.
Yeah, and that's the one I was like, man, they need to follow him. That kid's got
stuff.
Who,
by the way, became the number one player in the world by the end of the year.
He's number one right now.
What's that?
He's number one right now. I'm just flexing the things I know about
tennis. Yes, that's right. He is number one right now, but he is injured, which is why he's not at the Australian Open either. So all the star power wasn't really there. But yeah, I would say the only last piece of this that I did not like in the documentary was the fact that they talked about how difficult it was for Ange Jabeur to play as a Tunisian and how hard it was for her in terms of, you know, financing and resources, and tennis is a money game. And all of those things are 1,000% true. But then they also had the American Jessica Pegula up there and did not mention the fact that she is the daughter of Terry Pegula, the billionaire owner of the Buffalo Sabres and the Buffalo Bills, but never talked about the advantages that you have to having resources. So if we're going to talk about how hard it is to play tennis when you don't have money, let's talk about the advantages of her being the three seed now, because she actually has a lot of money. Instead, when it comes to rich people, all we do is say they work really, really hard. But when you don't come from resources, we emphasize all the things that you don't have. On that note, we are done with Meadowlarkers 64. I will say two things. Number one, we will see you next week, Meadowlarkers 65. And also, go out and pre-order Kate Fagan's new book, Hoop Muses, coming out March 7th, 2023, from 12 Books.
Thanks, Howard.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike. And typically, I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right. You crack that puppy open and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting and rules for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text LOSE to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text LOSE to 200-300. That's LOSE to 200-300. LOSE to 200-300.